Welcome back to State of Belief Radio. I'm Interfaith Alliance President Reverend Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch. Rabbi Dr. Jay Michelson is a commentator on CNN and a columnist for Rolling Stone. He was the Supreme Court columnist at the Daily Beast for 8 years. Jay is the author of 10 books, including best-selling God vs. Gay? The Religious Case for Equality, and is an affiliated professor at Chicago Theological Seminary. Jay holds a PhD in Jewish thought from Hebrew University, a JD from Yale Law School, and a non-denominational rabbinic ordination. I read something you wrote on Facebook around guns and religion, and you essentially said we can no longer use the exposition of facts and arguments to move the needle on gun violence in this country, because guns in this country have the similarity to religious belief. Can you say more about what you were getting at with that?
Sure. Yeah, and I've been developing kind of some more writing about this it's a picture of me in mid thought or mid flight. You know, for me, I think a lot of times whenever there's a horrifying episode of gun violence, liberals kind of wring our hands and we say, what's it going to take? How much more is it going to take? It's clear that the answer to that question is nothing. It's never going to be enough because, like in a religious context, both sides have their narrative. So, and any new facts are assimilated into that narrative. It's not like there would have to be some enormous catastrophe for the narrative to actually be shifted. So when an episode of gun violence happens, right, liberals think about guns, conservatives think about mental health, which they don't mean mental health in the sort of psychoanalytic sense, but really it's spiritual health, that this is a symptom of a spiritual crisis that needs religious remedies. Liberals ask, how come we can't have gun control? Conservatives are, and I say religious conservatives are hard right conservatives, not moderates, say, oh, here they come, coming for our freedom again. So the narratives are already in place, and they've been that way now for at least a decade. The conservative narrative holds sway at the Supreme Court and has impacted, you can see it in the language of several recent Supreme Court opinions, especially the most recent one, the Bruin case. And it's just not the idea that someday the other side is going to just wake up, that conservatives are somehow asleep or stupid or uninformed. That's both false and patronizing. They're not informed. They're very informed. They have a different ideological map for understanding this crisis. And so I think we need to shift, at least in the sort of way we talk about this, away from this notion of like we're trying to make some kind of court case and we can bring some evidence, and toward language of recovery from religion and what it takes to shift someone from a sort of religious belief. And, you know, you and I have a background in this, particularly around civil rights and LGBTQ equality and religion, that we know that just marshaling facts and evidence and talking, this is not how it works, right? That there has to be a real personal impact, either directly or knowing someone or encountering it even through the media. And these are the kinds of tools that I think we need to reach for in the gun debate. No, that's right. And look, there is a political element to this, which is, and I'm sure listeners know this, a large majority of Americans support what we would call sensible gun safety regulations, whether it's banning the AR-15 completely, whether it's background checks or other sort of what we might think of as common sense steps. And so a lot of this is a political issue about the kind of right-wing capture of the Republican Party, right? So in a normal situation, if there's a party that has kind of its extreme wing and its more moderate wing, there might be some balance between those two. But since 2016, that hasn't been the case in the Republican Party. And to move at all from the dogma, the religious dogma, that this is about freedom, this is a core element. And again, this is a religious ideology. This is a core element of my autonomy as a human being, my dignity, it's also gendered, my dignity as a man, my strength, my ability to protect my family. These aren't kind of legal political values. These are moral and religious values. And when it's perceived that, you know, liberals or progressives are coming to take away our guns, it is perceived. We can joke and say, oh, it's like emasculation or castration, but it is actually perceived as an attack on the individual autonomy and humanity of these mostly white, mostly Christian men who are kind of leading this movement. And that is, again, just as kind of, I would say, healing from that movement, but also just embedding in it, this is religion. And sometimes it's explicitly tied to religion. Obviously, we saw that every NRA convention has a large presence of white Christian nationalists and all of the accoutrements of that movement as well. But even when it's not made explicit, what's at stake is not a constitutional right or constitutional freedom, just as it was, again, just I think in past civil rights struggles. What's at stake, except here reversed, is a contestation of the humanity of the people involved in the debate. And that calls for a very different way of talking, a way of speaking about these crises. And I think you're right. Look, I mean, the way we're headed every day is going to be the, you know, year's anniversary of some mass shooting event. But that is certainly true in the Uvalde case as well.
Isn't it? I mean, what you're saying just makes a kind of horrifying sense. And, you know, as someone who thinks about freedom of religion a lot, it is very interesting to think about the use of freedom of religion overlaid on the Second Amendment and what a powerful kind of a toxic brew that could be, given the way that people are talking about freedom of religion as an excuse to discriminate, as an excuse to, you know, and then to have that overlaid with guns. I think you're like actually getting at, you know, some real pathology. You know, sorry to be judgmental, but it feels like a real problem that we are facing in this country, where guns and freedom of and guns and religion and a kind of false flag patriotism are coming into congruence with one another.
It does feel that way, and even more, I think, than in the religious liberty debates, which again you and I have been, you know, heavily involved with over the last 15 years. Here it feels even more personal in a sense. You know, there is this sense of my autonomy as a cake baker is being violated if I have to bake a cake or sell a cake to a same-sex couple. And that is how it's understood. Here it feels even more intense. It's my ability to protect my family, to be a man, to be a free person in this society. And, you know, the easiest, the lowest hanging fruit might be, if we could wave a magic wand, which we can't, would be to sort of do away with some of the incitement and disinformation that comes from right-wing media. Obviously, nothing can be done around the NRA, although maybe that's not true. The NRA used to stand for reasonable, you know, gun control and gun safety, you know, until the takeover in the 1970s. There's a wonderful organization called Every Town for Gun Safety. Sure. Nowhere will you find in their positions the view that, you know, we want to get rid of all guns. They say the opposite, you know, that small handguns and things.
And I think the parallel of like the Southern Baptist Convention takeover at the same time, and this is a moment where like the kind of fundamentalist ideology started to kick in both with guns and religion. On the religion side, on a lot of Christian fundamentalist takeover of institutions that had been more moderate or conservative, but not fundamentalist. And now we it's just an interesting kind of confluence.
Well, and what's that responding to, right? I mean, it's responding to civil rights in the 1960s, right? Some measure more of equality for people of color in this country. Responding to the sexual revolution of the 1960s, some more measure of some equality for women and at that time for gay and lesbian people. Like the changes which are still contested today. And which now in some states, you know, in particular Florida, we can't even teach about, right? So it's like this never happened. There never was systemic racism. We're not even allowed to say these words, right? It's the same, you know, here we are 50 years later, but it does feel like some of the same battle lines that gave birth, and I completely agree. And look, that takeover happened, extended to the Republican Party. Right. Totally. If you look at Ronald Reagan in the 60s, you know, and you know, when he was starting out, he didn't regard the kind of what now is known as the Christian right favorably. You know, he thought they were nuts. But then by the time 76 and then 1980 came around, of course, they propelled him to victory in 1980. So the takeover was also of that party as well.
I will say about 1980 over an evangelical Christian candidate.
That's right. That's
Jimmy
right.
Carter. I mean,
that's right. Which, of course, gives the lie to the claim that, you know, white Christian nationalism is Christian first and foremost. Right. I mean, this is an American white nationalist movement.
Right. Correct. So interesting. I really appreciate all your insight into the Supreme Court, and I'm dismayed by what's happening. And I don't feel like I can look to the Supreme Court to protect my family, to protect the people I love.
I look to the Supreme Court to threaten my family, whether right. it's rolling back. If it's not undoing same-sex marriage, then it's certainly limiting what that means. There's already a plurality on the court for saying that marriage, some marriages are more equal than others. That's already been decided, that just because you have marriage doesn't mean you have all the rights that come with marriage. And that's from my position. Obviously, if I was looking, if I were a person of color looking at this and looking at the end of affirmative action, which is now probably this month, right. you know, within the next 30 days, you know, this is not a court that's kind of sitting on the sidelines. They're aggressively fighting the culture war from one side. And it is, you know, I'm not one of those. I think I see myself as a pragmatist in the way I look at political issues. And so I hesitate to kind of blame, you know, administrations for not doing more and things like that. But there was a period where there were enough people in power to have reformed the court, and they did nothing. The Biden Commission on the Supreme Court, you know, they looked at a lot of options and then didn't get behind any of them. That to me was outrageous. And, you know, we're sitting with the Supreme Court and, of course, with the federal judiciary. And look, now at this moment, because of Senator Feinstein from California, the Biden administration isn't able to fill as many judicial vacancies as they would like to do. So there are individual people who are now standing in the way of progress, even, you know, in Senator Feinstein's case, somebody who fought for progress her entire life. So there really was a missed opportunity to address the court in a more systemic way, in a way that could perhaps have led to some hope for more balance. That ship has sailed. And as you know very well, and probably listeners do as well, there's even more money now in the sort of Leonard Leo megalopolis of shifting the courts and shifting local governments as well, which appears to be where he's focused now.
I'll be back to talk more with Jay Michelson after this break. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance.